We were there at the dawn of the third age of mankind, in the Earth year 2257, deep in neutral space. We were there when the last of the Babylon stations was founded. The name of the pod is Babylon 5.
Born to the Purple, in which we see a softer side of Ambassador Londo Mollari, learn that IT security in the 23rd century is terrible, and Commander Sinclair goes undercover in full action guy hero mode.
Welcome to episode 4 of The Name of the Pod, our look at the ongoing legacy and the influence of Babylon 5. I'm your co-host, Chris Tatro.
And I'm your co-host, John Cassie.
Today we're going to be taking a look at Season 1, Episode 3, Born to the Purple. And the topics that we're going to discuss today are telepaths. We've got some meat, actually, from Talia Winter. So we're going to be looking at the role that telepaths are playing in society and politics. Politics of the Centauri. What the heck are they exactly, other than having awesome hair? So we've got some more Ivanova bits coming up, and as I've been accused of being a Claudia Christian fanboy, that I can't turn down the opportunity to talk about Susan Ivanova, and a couple of bibs and bobs here and there to address along the way. In overall, what I thought was a episode, you know.
Yeah, I think it's fine.
If Soul Hunter was maybe a C minus, I'd give this one, you know, this one might be like a C plus B minus kind of territory.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I'd agree.
We get some good, you know, it's going to get a couple steps up from just having Londo in a prominent role, but it's just kind of there in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And I sort of wonder why, because we've got, you know, Londo content is usually, at least I usually find it a little more engaging, mm-hmm. right? And as I said in a previous episode, if I'm going to have Lita Alexander or Talia Winters, I find Talia Winters more compelling.
Right.
So, you know, we've got a lot of her and we've got a lot of Londo. And yet, somehow, this doesn't really come together for me. Now, I think that part of it, for me, undoubtedly comes from the sort of incoherence. This is where we're doing this again. Mm-hmm. What exactly is going on in Centauri society? You know, who are these people? What are they about? Okay, we get, I think, very clear evidence that they are an aristocracy,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, the Mollari, the House of Mollari, whatever that is, it is a thing, right?
Yeah,
because we learn about the role of kind of blackmail and power, mm-hmm. the vendetta. Right. I mean, you know, Chris, you and I were both educated in Roman history, you know, at UMass. Right. You took Carlin Barton's Roman class. Right.
Right.
OK. Well,
right.
I mean, even though that was 100 years ago for you and me now, you know, I learned about Roman society as essentially being like Goodfellas. Mm-hmm. Right. And on some level, that's what we're kind of being offered that. In this episode, but not really, right?
No. Carlin Barton would, of course, scold us for the analogy, because they don't possess the manliness. The Centauri don't possess the manliness necessary for Rome. These
that's
are more
right,
like our
right.
soft Greeks,
right?
So maybe this is more like an Athens than a Rome kind of situation,
right?
It's unclear exactly. You know, they operate through blackmail, through backstabbing, through conniving, and is that the kind of structure that could maintain a star empire of a couple of hundred years?
Right, and perhaps it's the reason why the thing ultimately collapsed.
Oh, no doubt.
Right, but I guess I want some of those notes hit more clearly, right? More firmly. Maybe we needed to see someone at Londo's power level at this stage. So we see two houses, you know, it's like, Hartrades and Harkonnen are in the Dune universe essentially equally powerful, right? And their conflict generates story. It generates knowledge, understanding of how this universe works in a way that this particular episode of Babylon 5, while giving us some things, gives it to us in a way that I find ultimately maybe not as helpful or as clear as I would have wanted.
We don't really have any other Centauri to round out our view of what's going on with these people. We've got Veer and we've got Adira, but they're not playing at the same level that Londo is. One being a slave and one being an assistant, you know, which is I would guess some sort of lower house. I think everything that the stuff that we're told in this episode about the Centauri, we kind of already knew.
That's right.
So this doesn't, you know, we're episode three and we're not getting new information. We're reinforcing what we knew. But, you know, I would almost rather that this early in, rather than doubling down on Centauri, that we learn more about the Narn.
Right.
You know, that we might maybe get a mention, another mention of the Vorlon, who, you know, hasn't shown up but for one or two lines in the first episode.
Right. Or indeed, give me something about Garibaldi.
Yeah.
Or give me something about Commander Sinclair, who's been playing off of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we haven't really had a chance to kind of dig down into him. What we're getting from humans, we're getting from Susan Ivanova. Which is great, because she's great, right?
Yep.
And she's actually got a little bit of, you know, a little bit of vinegar, right? Mm. So we get a little bit of
a healthy dash of vinegar,
right? We get a little salt and pepper on her interactions with, you know, the kind of the universe.
I fear for Garibaldi's life if he keeps touching her console.
Correct.
I think that will end poorly for him.
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
I don't know even why we're talking about him, since he's going to be written out of the show in two episodes for touching her console, right? I mean, he only makes it five episodes, right?
And
then we get Kaniki, right?
He'll get spaced very soon.
Right.
But, you know, okay, I have to do another side note on this. You know, these gold channel transmissions, this sort of B-plot that's going on.
Yes.
And, you know, Garibaldi can't figure it out. Only you know, senior staff know about these things. And it's going to a location in the Russian consortium. Ivanova can't open her mouth without mentioning that she's Russian, you know. Mm-hmm. And it takes him until the third act to make the connection that maybe he should ask her about it, or that she might be involved in this in some way. I mean, come on. You're smarter than that. You know, I hope.
Or at least you should be.
Yeah. Right? And you know, well, nobody except for the senior staff even know about these, you know, these gold channels. Well, and all the other, you know, crew members who are on the bridge when you're having this open conversation about them, apparently. So, you know, good security there, Michael. Good security.
Yeah, you carry on running that station like a sieve. Yeah. Were you anywhere near Babylon's 1, 2, and 3, Michael Garibaldi?
Yeah. Where were you?
I'm pinning this on you.
I want to know your whereabouts in that situation.
Yeah, exactly. So look, you know, you and I'm just going to come at this for a minute as a role playing game master.
Okay.
You and I together are coming up on like 100 years experience of game mastering, right?
Easily.
Even when we're painting a sketch of a culture, if you're GMing, you know more about a society, I know more about a society I'm creating than it would appear JMS knows about the Centauri. And I can't believe that he doesn't know more, so I'm wondering why it doesn't get translated, right? You know, I get the notes that he's got. You know, okay, so, you know, like I said, aristocracy, vendetta, blackmail, the value of information, houses, right? But Londo and everyone else is not even consistent about what they call their own country.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And I will reject that that this isn't one thing or another. Right? If you have an emperor, which we don't know yet whether they do, you mm-hmm. are an empire. And if you don't, you aren't. And if you're a republic with an empire, you're still going to call yourself a republic.
Yeah.
You know, the United States has imperial holdings all over the planet, right? But we don't call ourselves the American Empire, right? Yeah. Unless we mean it ironically or we mean yeah. it as a critique, right?
And we don't flip-flop between calling them
no.
the same, you know, the two different things,
no.
you know, especially when we are – if we were to be an ambassador representing our people
right.
at this kind of level.
Right. We would have a very particular and political line that we're always going to be hewing to make sure that other countries see us the way we want them to see us.
Yeah.
And I just have a hard time believing that the Centauri are going to want the other nations to be thinking about that 100 sector empire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to want to be thinking yeah. about a small, you know, innocent little republic, you know.
Mm. Or that they want people to think of them as the empire that they used to be, that they
yeah.
were.
Yeah.
When really they're really fallen. They're really more of a republic now. But you know, you would think they would be consistent. You know, the other side, though, says Londo doesn't really care. He hasn't shown a mm-hmm. lot of interest in being an ambassador. You know, he's
yeah.
more interested in gambling. He's more interested in dancing girls.
Right.
He's interested in pretty much everything except why he's here. You know, to represent this consortium, you know, whatever
right.
we're going to call it.
Whatever it is, right.
That is well past its prime and is dying on the vine.
Yeah.
So maybe he's flip-flopping because he doesn't care, but I think it's just not, you know, it's the script writing isn't tight around
yeah.
what we're representing the Centauri as.
Yeah. And you know, maybe this goes back to your point is making me think that maybe what this episode really needed was a conflict with another house, another Centauri of equal power
mm-hmm.
to Londo, so we could see what that looks like. I mean, you know, if
yeah.
to your point, we've got Londo, and then people under him are subordinate to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not going to give us enough contrast. And his rival is not even really Centauri.
No, I'm not sure what Trachis is.
Although
yeah,
I don't,
he looks
but I don't think
like,
he's a Centauri.
No, no, I think he's Meatloaf from the Anything for Love video. is what I immediately thought of him as, portrayed by Clive Revel, who better known as the voice of the Emperor in The Empire Strikes Back.
What?
Another? Yeah, yeah, he was the voice. He wasn't the face. That was a woman in prosthetics with chimpanzee eyes, but
oh
he was the
God.
Voice of the Emperor. Yeah, it was horrific. But he was the voice of the Emperor, and then they
huh.
moved on to Ian McDiarmid for the Jedi and all. But yeah, he's another one of these guys with just this long IMDb page, mostly voice
right.
voice credits and whatnot.
Right.
He's done a lot of voice stuff,
right.
but
like William
yeah,
Morgan
been,
Shepherd,
exactly.
From,
yeah,
from Soul Hunter. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, Clive Revel was in Lois and Clark. I'm surprised you don't remember him from that.
As what?
I don't know. It was a sorcerer. He portrayed
a sorcerer. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well. But
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he's an adversary. He's not on the same level as Londo, and I think
right.
that's a shame because
yeah, right.
I liked him as a character. He was
Trachis.
Yes, Trachis.
Yeah, Trachis is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he's playing both ends. You know,
right.
he's screwing over Londo, but then when Adira runs, he goes to Londo and says, "Oh, she was going to screw us both." You know, it was
right.
terrible. You know, I wish that he had come back and be, you know, cuz I feel like we need some sort of shady underworld character who's not a Mantis, you know, on this show to be you know, we need the Quark. We need somebody who's right. who's not at the diplomatic or military level of things.
Right, right. I would like to hear Clive Revel say, "You are part of the Centauri Republic and a traitor. Take him away."
Absolutely.
So look, this is you know, I've been on this for 12 minutes, so you know, enough of me ranting about the Centauri and the politics and the speed at which these cultures are being developed, but it really continues to stick that to me that look, you're this far in now, right? You're many hours into developing these cultures. You've given two passes now. Mm-hmm. At the Centauri, and I still feel like, no, I could know a lot more about them, and I really should.
Yeah.
Right. What I know is interesting, but it's also to me incoherent and sort of inconsistent, and I'm looking forward to getting some real clarity, you know, down the road.
And you know? Which is, it's strange because they are the one alien culture of them. Where we've seen multiple representatives so far.
That's right. That's right.
That we've got Veer, we've got Adira, but we still don't have anything. We only have very loose sketches of any of them to this point.
Right. And you know, at this level of development, mm-hmm. we're not in this show is now building on its legacy, right?
Mm-hmm.
This culture is no clearer at this stage of development. Than say the Klingons were after we'd had three episodes of them in the original series.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like they're mysterious in the way, say, the Romulans were.
Right.
Right? Like, oh, you don't know about the Romulans. You know, the Centauri mm-hmm. are not the Vorlon. Right?
Right. Right.
You know, I think that a claim is sort of being made that we've told you about these Centauri, but I'm just mm-hmm. not sure that I buy it yet. And until we get there, I'm feeling like, no, I need more. I need a telepath, Chris.
Yeah, yeah.
I need a telepath to open up these Centauri for me.
Brilliant segue. You know, this is why we pay you the big bucks, John.
Whoop, whoop.
Yep. So telepaths. We've had two telepaths. We've had two telepaths now in the series. We've had Leta Alexander.
Yep.
And we have Talia Winter now, the telepath on board. She introduced herself as a commercial telepath.
Yes.
Is that the phrase she uses? Yeah.
Yes.
Which is an interesting distinction. Because
she talks about having served in the political wing, or the political bureau, which suggests that there are also maybe political telepaths or police telepaths, something like that.
And you know, we see her there to oversee a commercial transaction, but she's also there, you know, with a diplomatic, setting to negotiate this Euphrates Treaty.
Right.
So, you know, what exactly does it mean to be a commercial telepath? And a bigger question: what does it mean? You know, we talked last time. What does it mean to have, this knowledge of souls in a society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to have telepaths in a society, in a culture? You know, known, proven, you know, scientifically, you know, provable. We can nail this down. People with psychic abilities.
Right.
What does it do to any kind of debate, any kind of political discussion, even commercial transactions? I can't imagine. Here in the year of our Lord 2017, you know, telepaths in a political campaign, at a debate in Congress, any of these things are, you know, it would be such a fundamental change,
right,
to how a society operates, and yet Earth doesn't seem to be all that changed. From what we've seen so far, we're still entrenched in the capitalism. We still have these. I mean, there's a one world government kind of thing. So the Illuminati have taken over and won, but things don't seem to be radically different. There still are political campaigns. We had a presidential campaign in Midnight on the Firing Line.
Right.
And this has been, you know, six generations back, that Leta said. was when they were keeping records.
Right.
So telepaths have been around for a long time. This isn't something new. I would think
a long time,
a much more great shift, societal shift. These are the kinds of things that make me think that, wow, this would just be so uprooting.
Right. Right. Almost everything that we think about the way society works would be affected by, would be transformed by the presence of telepaths. Mm-hmm. In the social space, right?
Yeah.
Politics, you know, kind of not even necessarily chief amongst them, but certainly among them, right? What would policing look like? You know, what would the legal system. What about entertainment? What about travel? What about telepaths and virtual spaces, right? Because Babylon 5 doesn't really go into that virtual reality conversation.
Thank goodness, because the level of effects early 1990s and with virtual reality.
Right. What was it? VR5?
VR5. Profit.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah.
Let's speak of this no more.
Yeah, right. I mean, we've got to see more. Well, and I suppose we do get a bit of that in when Susan Ivanova and Talia Winters are talking about Ivanova's mother.
Yeah.
Right? And Talia says, "Well, you can't just have telepaths not being not being managed. You would undo civilization."
Yeah, I mean, they wear the badge, you know, so they can be identified
as
a telepath, because you certainly don't want to be just having a random conversation with someone and then, you know, 20 minutes later find out they're a telepath and they've been reading your surface thoughts the whole time.
Right.
I mean, it's already uncanny enough that my wife can do this to me. I don't want this to happen with a stranger on the street.
Correct.
It's an established part of Earth culture. I mean, we don't know how deep or how expansive the Psi-Corps is.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the way that they
But, you know, certainly they've got enough that they've now sent their second one to Babylon 5.
Right.
And that a relative of one of the core player characters is one.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it seems numerous enough that it should be really touching every layer of society.
Right. You know. Go.
But you also have the question of, all right, so a telepath says something, says, "Oh, this person is lying." Well, how do you trust that what that telepath is saying is true?
Right.
So they have to be, I don't know, policed or licensed in some way to get to that level of trust.
Right.
Right. Because, you know, if I go into an economic, some sort of like deal on eBay or something and you know, there's a telepath sitting there saying, "No, this person's lying. The thing is really in terrible condition." Well, you know, maybe the telepath is pushing their own agenda.
Right.
So that's a question, or, you know, we'd have each side in a political arena would be accusing the other side's telepaths of lying and distorting the truth. And, you know, clearly we can't trust them unless we have other telepaths also scanning the telepaths.
Right.
Which gets complex very quickly.
And so what we've got here is sort of a little bit of reflected understanding of that in the way that the humans kind of agree to manipulate Trakis, right? And Talia Winters' willingness to manipulate Trakis tells us something about her, that the where the gray area for her is, right? And the fact that she's willing to go into that gray area and a military personnel are not concerned about that tells us a little bit about the military's relationship with the Psi-Corps, right?
Yeah. And yeah, it's definitely not part of the structured military, because if we've seen anything about Sinclair, you know, at this point, that he is a by the book kind of guy. Right, well, right. Mostly, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah, he presents as kind of a straight arrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a Law and Order, you know, you can trust me, you know, this kind of thing.
He's no Earnest. Laurel Takashima, but yeah.
Yeah, he's no Laurel Takashima. Certainly no Susan Ivanova in terms of being willing to, you know,
To skirt
around the corners, you know.
Yeah. But you're right, you know, it's a gray area. You know, she says, well, you know, I can sort of trick him into presenting his surface thoughts in this way.
Right.
But
I'm watching it going, too clever by half, Talia Winters.
Yeah, or too clever by half, J. Michael Straczynski to leave this kind of loophole in here for your characters. But if they have this level of rules and regulations within the Psi-Corps of what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, I would assume that there would be someone checking up on that.
Right.
And, you know, whether it's regular, I know certainly within my work, we have auditors that come in, internal auditors that make sure that we're following all the processes. Well, if those internal auditors are telepaths, and I'm going to sit there and say, yeah, I know I haven't violated the code at all. You know, of course, I'm now thinking, well, except for that one time with Trakis, and bing, 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 bing. So that's, you know, I don't want Walter Koenig grilling me over that situation anytime soon.
Right, right. I like the way that they give us a kind of nicely nuanced perspective on Psi-Corps and on telepaths, right? That we've got a number of different views of them, you know, ambivalent, hostile, instrumental, you know, I'm going to use you. I don't have a moral or ethical position, but I do have a commercial position.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that is, you know, that works somehow.
Yeah, but we don't have really anything on who Talia Winters is as a person yet.
Nothing.
You know, we've, I think really.
Well, not nothing. I think that's unfair. You know, she made in that whole first episode, she was trying to establish a connection with Susan Ivanova.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she actually knew Ivanova's backstory.
Mm, and she was deliberately pushing. I didn't get that.
Well, she's trying to build a relationship, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, Lita Alexander always felt like I could make a huge claim from an hour and a half telemovie. But Lita Alexander had some distance.
Mm-hmm.
Talia Winters appears to want to really engage and to have personal relationships.
Yeah. Well, half that time, Lita Alexander was actually being impersonated by a shapeshifter. So it's hard
to
tell. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I look forward to seeing more about who Talia is and not just having telepathy as a plot device, which I think is what we've had, you know, in Midnight on the Firing Line. I don't think the plot would have moved along if she hadn't randomly bumped into Londo and gotten the flash of him going and about to kill Jakar.
Right, right.
And here, you know, we wouldn't be able to move the plot along and entrap or find out what had happened to Adira if we didn't have a telepath there.
Right, right.
So don't turn telepathy into a crutch. JMS, I'm speaking over, you know, 25 years of of time back to you. Don't lean on this crutch. Make her a person, not just a set of abilities.
Exactly. You had some bibs and bobs.
Just a little bit. The scene with Ivanova's father passing.
Yeah,
that was a little rough.
Yeah,
you know, for a guy who just came out of a coma and, you know, dies at the end of his speech. He seemed kind of perky.
You're being unkind.
that's a foundation of my personality.
Yeah, right.
So that was one Bib and Bob. And the other, right. You know, we get Garibaldi reading Universe Today, which Universe instead of USA Today, isn't that?
Har har har.
Yeah, you know, it's a little you know, laughing up the sleeve at that. But he's reading a gosh darn newspaper.
Right.
Okay. Maybe iPads weren't around in 1994, so we can't blame that. But you know, Star Trek, everybody's reading on their
right.
their pads, their devices. Right. You know, everything else is on a computer screen. What, I can't even imagine the logistics of running printing presses on Babylon 5,
right.
importing the wood pulp to produce
right.
newspaper, or maybe they just, you know, run the, you know, fly the papers out there. Maybe they don't print them there. Maybe they just right. fly them through a jump gate every day.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe it's
a special kind of e-paper.
Ooh.
You know,
just sort of vaporizes at the
exactly.
end of the day.
Yeah, and it just becomes you drop it into the e-paper recycling vortex, and it's reused. Maybe something like that.
That'd be very ecological of them. It's like the Mimbari soul perspective for raw materials.
It's all about recycling. This is all what we learned from the Mimbari.
It's banana peels and poo and all these sort of things that are pressed each day into a new newspaper.
Yeah,
that's fine. That's making a lot of sense to me at the moment. Anyway, that bothered me, you know, almost to the level that Londo
of distraction.
You know, using you know, Republic and Empire in the same episode bothered you. So that was a bit of a problem for me. And
right.
and you know, again, the Mantis guy. Who, according to the internet, I had to look him up, was named Nagraf, and I don't know that we see him again after this episode, and I'm quite thankful because he's a pretty terrible effect.
Yeah, I don't think we get him anymore, do we?
Yeah. No, I Googled him because I wanted to know if this thing even had a name, and apparently he goes away. So I'm happy. He bothered me. I don't know why. Maybe I'm speciesist or something. But he just really, really bothered me.
Yeah, we agree.
But I do like the mention of these gold channels for transmissions because it did one again. Things bother me. Okay, I get bothered by a lot of things. Again, another foundation of my personality. Since the first episode, I've been bothered by instantaneous communication to Earth.
Yes.
When Space Joe Biden is on the comm screen, you know, it's like, how does this happen? You know, how does light, okay, are they bouncing it through a jump gate? Well, the gate's not always open. How is this exactly working? So maybe, is this available to everybody? Well, apparently not. I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that Space Joe Biden was using the gold channel communication to Commander Sinclair. So that's answered a question for me. Anybody else who wants to talk to their relatives back home, it's going to be delayed by, geez, I don't even know how many light years are we away from Earth that this station set up? I don't think we're told how far it is.
No, we're deep in neutral territory, Chris.
Yeah. Okay. We know where that is. So we can base our communication time back to Earth on that.
Right.
And
anyone listening, if you are aware of a galactic map that shows the relationship of all of these powers to each other and where these planets are. I've never seen such a thing on the interwebs or anywhere else, and you know, I would love to see such a thing if it exists. Drop it in, you know, drop us a line, nameofthepod@gmail.com to show us where that is if you've got it.
Yeah. Well, that's all my 2 minutes hate for this episode, or my list of things that I've that have been sort of a bee in my bonnet. So
okay.
I think we can get onto our constant, our piece of the program where we talk about our favorite line of dialogue or a particular line of dialogue that stands out in the episode for better or for worse.
Right. And mine is from Londo. What do you want, you moon-faced assassin of joy?
A great line.
A great line.
You're always bringing the power of positivity and the good lines to this podcast.
Maybe I'm saving the real stinkers for when we get there. I don't know. I mean, or I'm just resonating with these funny lines. You know, I don't know.
I worry if if we haven't hit the real stinkers yet, then boy, you know, maybe I've dulled them in my memory from watching this,
correct,
you know, back in the 90s. But I also had a Londo. It's his long speech about we Centauri live for appearances and position, status, title. These are the things by which we define ourselves. But when I look beneath the mask I am forced to wear, I see only emptiness. And then I think of you and I say, the hell with appearances. And it was,
yeah,
it was a mouthful, and it was, I mean, it was delivered with Peter Jurassic's, you know, great ability, but right, it still kind of just sat there in the scene.
Right.
And, so
yeah, you're totally right. You're totally, yeah, right. That is it's an emblematic, mm-hmm, Straczynski line.
Yeah, but I'm going to, from now on, refer to you as my moon-faced assassin of joy.
I have for the longest time, Chris, referred to you as my moon-faced assassin of joy. Mm. Good. We've arrived at a stasis point in our relationship.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. And that seems a good point as any to end the episode.
Right.
I'll be back next time looking at episode 4 of season 1, Infection.
Infection. Mm.
Yes.
Yes.
So
we're no doubt, then, Chris, you're going to unpack for me that some random guest star in this was, you know, the star of Project Blue Book, or or was a, you know, some other, you know, was actually a Barry, yeah, Morse on Space 1999, or God only knows,
exactly,
what else you're going to find.
Yeah, some sort of, you know, Jason and the space pirates.
Jason of Star Command.
Show? Star Command. Jason of Star Command. One of those things you always talk about. Okay.
Because right,
we're both older than dirt.
That's right.
But that's it for this episode. Until next time, don't give away the homeworld.
Don't give away the homeworld.
Yep.
See you, folks.